fraught with grief and panic. Langdon moved toward her again instinctively, but Kohler intervened. "Mr. Langdon." Kohler's face was expressionless. He motioned Langdon out of earshot. Langdon reluctantly followed, leaving Victoria to fend for herself.
"You're the specialist," Kohler said, his whisper intense. "I want to know what these Illuminati bastards intend to do with this antimatter."
Langdon tried to focus. Despite the madness around him, his first reaction was logical. Academic rejection. Kohler was still making assumptions, impossible assumptions. "The Illuminati are defunct, Mr. Kohler. I stand by that. This crime could be anything. Maybe even another CERN employee who found out about Mr. Vaithra's breakthrough and thought the project was too dangerous to continue." Kohler looked stunned.
"You think this is a crime of conscience, Mr. Langdon? Absurd. Whoever killed Leonardo wanted one thing, the antimatter specimen. And no doubt they have plans for it."
"You mean terrorism?"
"Plainly.
But the Illuminati were not terrorists."
"Tell that to Leonardo Vaithra."
Langdon felt a pang of truth in the statement. Leonardo Vaithra had indeed been branded with the Illuminati symbol. Where had it come from? The sacred brand seemed too difficult a hoax for someone trying to cover his tracks by casting suspicion elsewhere. There had to be another explanation. Again, Langdon forced himself to consider the implausible. If the Illuminati were still active, and if they stole the antimatter, what would be their intention? What would be their target? The answer, furnished by his brain, was instantaneous. Langdon dismissed it just as fast. True, the Illuminati had an obvious enemy, but a wide-scale terrorist attack against that enemy was inconceivable. It was entirely out of character. Yes, the Illuminati had killed people, but individuals, carefully conscripted targets. Mass destruction was somehow heavy-handed. Langdon paused. Then again, he thought, there would be a rather majestic eloquence to it. Antimatter, the ultimate scientific achievement being used to vaporize. He refused to accept the preposterous thought. "There is," he said suddenly, "a logical explanation other than terrorism." Kohler stared, obviously waiting. Langdon tried to sort out the thought. The Illuminati had always wielded tremendous power through financial means. They controlled banks. They owned gold bullion. They were even rumored to possess the single most valuable gem on Earth, the Illuminati diamond, a flawless diamond of enormous proportions. "Money," Langdon said. "The antimatter could have been stolen for financial gain." Kohler looked incredulous.
"Financial gain? Where does one sell a droplet of antimatter?"
"Not the specimen," Langdon countered. "The technology. Antimatter technology must be worth a mint. Maybe someone stole the specimen to do analysis and R&D.
"Industrial espionage? But that canister has 24 hours before the batteries die. The researchers would blow themselves up before they learned anything at all."
"They could recharge it before it explodes. They could build a compatible recharging podium like the ones here at CERN."
"In 24 hours? Kohler challenged. "Even if they stole the schematics, a recharger like that would take months to engineer, not hours."
"He's right." Victoria's voice was frail. Both men turned. Victoria was moving toward them, her gait as tremulous as her words.
"He's right. Nobody could reverse engineer a recharger in time. The interface alone would take weeks. Flux filters, servo coils, power conditioning alloys, all calibrated to the specific energy grade of the locale."
Langdon frowned. The point was taken. An antimatter trap was not something one could simply plug into a wall socket. Once removed from CERN, the canister was on a one-way, 24-hour trip to oblivion. Which left only one very disturbing conclusion.
"We need to call Interpol," Victoria said. Even to herself, her voice sounded distant. We need to call the proper authorities, immediately.
Kohler shook his head. Absolutely not.
The words stunned her. No. What do you mean?
You and your father have put me in a very difficult position here.
Director, we need help. We need to find that trap and get it back here before someone gets hurt. We have a responsibility.
We have a responsibility to think,
Kohler said, his tone hardening.
This situation could have very, very serious repercussions for CERN.
You're worried about CERN's reputation? Do you know what that canister could do in an urban area? It has a blast radius of a half mile, 9 city blocks.
Perhaps you and your father should have considered that before you created the specimen.
Vittoria felt like she'd been stabbed.
But we took every precaution.
Apparently, it was not enough.
But somebody knew about the antimatter. She realized, of course, it was an absurd argument. Of course somebody knew. Someone had found out. Vittoria had told no one. That left only two explanations. Either her father had taken someone into his confidence without telling her, which made no sense because it was her father who had sworn them both to secrecy, or she and her father had been monitored. The cell phone, maybe? She knew they had spoken a few times while Vittoria was traveling. Had they said too much? It was possible. There was also their email. But they had been discreet, hadn't they? CERN security system? Had they been monitored somehow without their knowledge? She knew none of that mattered anymore. What was done was done. My father is dead. The thought spurred her into action. She pulled her cell phone from her shorts pocket. Kohler accelerated toward her, coughing violently, eyes flashing anger.
Who are you calling?
CERN's switchboard. They can connect us to Interpol.
Think?
Kohler choked, screeching to a halt in front of her.
Are you really so naive? That canister could be anywhere in the world by now. No intelligence agency on Earth could possibly mobilize to find it in time.
So we do nothing? Vittoria felt compunction challenging a man in such frail health, but the director was so far out of line, she didn't even know him anymore.
We do what is smart, Kohler said. We don't risk CERN's reputation by involving authorities who cannot help anyway. Not yet. Not without thinking.
Vittoria knew there was logic somewhere in Kohler's argument, but she also knew that logic, by definition, was bereft of moral responsibility. Her father had lived for moral responsibility, careful science, accountability, faith in man's inherent goodness. Vittoria believed in those things, too, but she saw them in terms of karma. Turning away from Kohler, she snapped open her phone.
You can't do that, he said.
Just try and stop me. Kohler didn't move. An instant later, Vittoria realized why. This far underground, her cell phone had no dial tone. Fuming, she headed for the elevator. Chapter 26. The Hashashin stood at the end of the stone tunnel. His torch still burned bright, the smoke mixing with the smell of moss and stale air. Silence surrounded him. The iron door blocking his way looked as old as the tunnel itself, rusted but still holding strong. He waited in the darkness, trusting. It was almost time. Janus had promised someone on the inside would open the door. The Hashashin marveled at the betrayal. He would have waited all night at the door to carry out his task, but he sensed it would not be necessary. He was working for determined men. Minutes later, exactly at the appointed hour, there was a loud clank of heavy keys on the other side of the door. Metal scraped on metal as multiple locks disengaged. One by one, three huge deadbolts ground open. The locks creaked as if they had not been used in centuries. Finally, all three were open.
Then there was silence. The Hashashin waited patiently, 5 minutes, exactly as he'd been told. Then, with electricity in his blood, he pushed. The great door swung open. Chapter 27.
Victoria, I will not allow it.
Kola's breath was labored and getting worse as the hazmat elevator ascended. Victoria blocked him out. She craved sanctuary, something familiar in this place that no longer felt like home. She knew it was not to be. Right now she had to swallow the pain and act. Get to a phone. Robert Langdon was beside her, silent as usual. Victoria had given up wondering who the man was. A specialist? Could Kohler be any less specific? Mr. Langdon can help us find your father's killer. Langdon was being no help at all. His warmth and kindness seemed genuine, but he was clearly hiding something. They both were. Kohler was at her again.
As director of CERN, I have a responsibility to the future of science. If you amplify this into an international incident and CERN suffers...
Future of science? Victoria turned on him. Do you really plan to escape accountability by never admitting this antimatter came from CERN? Do you plan to ignore the people's lives we put in danger?
Not we, Kohler countered. You. You and your father.
Victoria looked away.
And as far as endangering lives, Kohler said, life is exactly what this is about. You know antimatter technology has enormous implications for life on this planet. If CERN goes bankrupt, destroyed by scandal, everybody loses. Man's future is in the hands of places like CERN, scientists like you and your father, working to solve tomorrow's problems.
Victoria had heard Kohler's Science as God lecture before, and she never bought it. Science itself caused half the problems it was trying to solve. Progress was Mother Earth's ultimate malignancy.
Scientific advancement carries risk, Kohler argued. It always has. Space programs, genetic research, medicine, they all make mistakes. Science needs to survive its own blunders at any cost, for everyone's sake.
Victoria was amazed at Kohler's ability to weigh moral issues with scientific detachment. His intellect seemed to be the product of an icy divorce from his inner spirit.
You think CERN is so critical to the Earth's future that we should be immune from moral responsibility?
Do not argue morals with me. You crossed a line when you made that specimen, and you have put this entire facility at risk. I'm trying to protect not only the jobs of the 3,000 scientists who work here, but also your father's reputation. Think about him. A man like your father does not deserve to be remembered as the creator of a weapon of mass destruction.
Victoria felt his spear hit home. I am the one who convinced my father to create that specimen. This is my fault. When the door opened, Kohler was still talking. Victoria stepped out of the elevator, pulled out her phone, and tried again. Still no dial tone.
Damn! She headed for the door.
Victoria, stop!
The director sounded asthmatic now as he accelerated after her.
Slow down. We need to talk.
Basta di parlare.
Think of your father, Kohler urged. What would he do?
She kept going.
Victoria, I haven't been totally honest with you.
Victoria felt her legs slow.
I don't know what I was thinking, Kohler said. I was just trying to protect you. Tell me what you want. We need to work together here.
Victoria came to a full stop halfway across the lab, but she did not turn.
I want to find the antimatter, and I want to know who killed my father.
She waited. Kohler sighed.
Victoria, we already know who killed your father. I'm sorry.
Now Victoria turned.
You what?
I didn't know how to tell you. It's a difficult...
You know who killed my father?
We have a very good idea, yes. The killer left something of a calling card. That's the reason I called Mr. Langdon. The group claiming responsibility is his specialty.
The group? A terrorist group?
Vittoria, they stole a quarter gram of antimatter.
Vittoria looked at Robert Langdon standing there across the room. Everything began falling into place. That explains some of the secrecy. She was amazed it hadn't occurred to her earlier. Kohler had called the authorities after all. The authorities. Now it seemed obvious. Robert Langdon was American, clean-cut, conservative, obviously very sharp. Who else could it be? Vittoria should have guessed from the start. She felt a newfound hope as she turned to him.
Mr. Langdon, I want to know who killed my father. And I want to know if your agency can find the antimatter.
Langdon looked flustered.
My agency?
You're with U.S. intelligence, I assume.
Actually, no.
Kohler intervened.
Mr. Langdon is a professor of art history at Harvard University.
Vittoria felt like she had been doused with ice water.
An art teacher?
He is a specialist in cult symbology, Kohler sighed. Vittoria, we believe your father was killed by a satanic cult.
Vittoria heard the words in her mind, but she was unable to process them.
A satanic cult?
The group claiming responsibility calls themselves the Illuminati.
Vittoria looked at Kohler and then at Langdon, wondering if this was some kind of perverse joke.
The Illuminati? She demanded. As in the Bavarian Illuminati?
Kohler looked stunned.
You've heard of them?
Vittoria felt the tears of frustration welling right below the surface.
Bavarian Illuminati, New World Order, Steve Jackson computer games. Half the techies here play it on the Internet.
Her voice cracked.
But I don't understand.
Kohler shot Langdon a confused look. Langdon nodded.
Popular game. Ancient Brotherhood takes over the world. Semi-historical.
I didn't know it was in Europe, too. Vittoria was bewildered.
What are you talking about? The Illuminati? It's a computer game.
Vittoria, Kohler said, the Illuminati is the group claiming responsibility for your father's death.
Vittoria mustered every bit of courage she could find to fight the tears. She forced herself to hold on and assess the situation logically. But the harder she focused, the less she understood. Her father had been murdered. CERN had suffered a major breach of security. There was a bomb counting down somewhere that she was responsible for. And the director had nominated an art teacher to help them find a mythical fraternity of Satanists. Vittoria felt suddenly all alone. She turned to go, but Kohler cut her off. He reached for something in his pocket. He produced a crumpled piece of fax paper and handed it to her. Vittoria swayed in horror as her eyes hit the image.
They branded him, Kohler said. They branded his goddamn chest.
Chapter 28. Secretary Sylvie Badaloc was now in a panic. She paced outside the director's empty office.
Where the hell is he? What do I do?
It had been a bizarre day. Of course, any day working for Maximilian Kohler had the potential to be strange, but Kohler had been in rare form today.
Find me Leonardo Vetra,
he had demanded when Sylvie arrived this morning. Dutifully, Sylvie paged, phoned, and emailed Leonardo Vetra. Nothing. So Kohler had left in a huff, apparently to go find Vetra himself. When he rolled back in a few hours later, Kohler looked decidedly not well. Not that he ever actually looked well, but he looked worse than usual. He locked himself in his office, and she could hear him on his modem, his phone, faxing, talking. Then Kohler rolled out again. He hadn't been back since. Sylvie had decided to ignore the antics as yet another Kohlerian melodrama, but she began to get concerned when Kohler failed to return at the proper time for his daily injections. The director's physical condition required regular treatment, and when he decided to push his luck, the results were never pretty. Respiratory shock, coughing fits, and a mad dash by the infirmary personnel. Sometimes Sylvie thought Maximilian Kohler had a death wish. She considered paging him to remind him, but she'd learned charity was something Kohler's pride despised. Last week, he had become so enraged with a visiting scientist who had shown him undue pity that Kohler clambered to his feet and threw a clipboard at the man's head. King Kohler could be surprisingly agile when he was pissé. At the moment, however, Sylvie's concern for the director's health was taking a back burner, replaced by a much more pressing dilemma. The CERN switchboard had phoned 5 minutes ago in a frenzy to say they had an urgent call for the director. "He's not available," Sylvie had said. Then the CERN operator told her who was calling. Sylvie half laughed aloud. "You're kidding, right?" She listened, and her face clouded with disbelief. "And your caller ID confirms..." Sylvie was frowning. "I see. Okay. Can you ask what the..." She sighed. "No. That's fine. Tell him to hold. I'll locate the director right away." "Yes, I understand. I'll hurry." But Sylvie had not been able to find the director. She had called his cell line 3 times and each time gotten the same message. "The mobile customer you are trying to reach is out of range." Out of range? How far could he go? So Sylvie had dialed Kohler's beeper. 2 times. No response. Most unlike him. She'd even emailed his mobile computer. Nothing. It was like the man had disappeared off the face of the earth. "So what do I do?" she now wondered. Short of searching CERN's entire complex herself, Sylvie knew there was only one other way to get the director's attention. He wouldn't be pleased, but the man on the phone was not someone the director should keep waiting. Nor did it sound like the caller was in any mood to be told the director was unavailable. Startled with her own boldness, Sylvie made her decision. She walked into Kohler's office and went to the metal box on the wall behind his desk. She opened the cover, stared at the controls, and found the correct button. Then she took a deep breath and grabbed the microphone. Chapter 29. Victoria didn't remember how they had gotten to the main elevator, but there they were. Ascending. Kohler was behind her, his breathing labored now. Langdon's concerned gaze passed through her like a ghost. He had taken the fax from her hand and slipped it in his jacket pocket, away from her sight, but the image was still burned into her memory. As the elevator climbed, Victoria's world swirled into darkness. "Papa!" In her mind, she reached for him. For just a moment, in the oasis of her memory, Victoria was with him. She was 9 years old, rolling down hills of Edelweiss flowers, the Swiss skies spinning overhead. "Papa! Papa!" Leonardo Vetra was laughing beside her, beaming. "What is it, Angel?" "Papa!" she giggled, nuzzling close to him. "Ask me what's the matter." "But you look happy, sweetie. Why would I ask you what's the matter?" "Just ask." He shrugged. "What's the matter?" She immediately started laughing. "What's the matter? Everything is the matter. Rocks, trees, atoms, even anteaters. Everything is the matter." He laughed.
"Did you make that up?"
"Pretty smart, huh?"
"My little Einstein."
She frowned. "He has stupid hair. I saw his picture."
"He's got a smart head, though. I told you what he proved, right?"
Her eyes widened with dread. "Dad, no. You promised." "E equals MC square." He tickled her playfully. "E equals MC square. "No math. I told you I hate it."
"I'm glad you hate it. Because girls aren't even allowed to do math."
Victoria stopped short. "They aren't."
"Of course not. Everyone knows that. Girls play with dollies. Boys do math. No math for girls. I'm not even permitted to talk to little girls about math."
"What? But that's not fair."
Rules are rules. Absolutely no math for little girls.
Vittoria looked horrified.
But dolls are boring.
I'm sorry, her father said. I could tell you about math, but if I got caught...
He looked nervously around the deserted hills. Vittoria followed his gaze.
Okay, she whispered. Just tell me quietly.
The motion of the elevator startled her. Vittoria opened her eyes. He was gone. Reality rushed in, wrapping a frosty grip around her. She looked to Langdon. The earnest concern in his gaze felt like the warmth of a guardian angel, especially in the aura of Kohler's chill. A single sentient thought began pounding at Vittoria with unrelenting force. Where is the antimatter? The horrifying answer was only a moment away. Chapter 30.
Maximilian Kohler, kindly call your office immediately.
Blazing sunbeams flooded Langdon's eyes as the elevator doors opened into the main atrium. Before the echo of the announcement on the intercom overhead faded, every electronic device on Kohler's wheelchair started beeping and buzzing simultaneously. His pager, his phone, his email. Kohler glanced down at the blinking lights in apparent bewilderment. The director had resurfaced, and he was back in range.
Director Kohler, please call your office.
The sound of his name on the PA seemed to startle Kohler. He glanced up, looking angered, and then almost immediately concerned. Langdon's eyes met his, and Vittoria's too. The three of them were motionless a moment, as if all the tension between them had been erased and replaced by a single, unifying foreboding. Kohler took his cell phone from the armrest. He dialed an extension and fought off another coughing fit. Vittoria and Langdon waited.
This is Director Kohler, he said, wheezing. Yes? I was subterranean, out of range.
He listened, his gray eyes widening.
Who? Yes. Patch it through.
There was a pause.
Hello? This is Maximilian Kohler. I am the director of CERN. With whom am I speaking?
Vittoria and Langdon watched in silence as Kohler listened.
It would be unwise, Kohler finally said, to speak of this by phone. I will be there immediately.
He was coughing again.
Meet me at Leonardo da Vinci Airport. 40 minutes.
Kohler's breath seemed to be failing him now. He descended into a fit of coughing and barely managed to choke out the words.
Locate the canister immediately. I'm coming.
Then he clicked off his phone. Vittoria ran to Kohler's side, but Kohler could no longer speak. Langdon watched as Vittoria pulled out her cell phone and paged CERN's infirmary. Langdon felt like a ship on the periphery of a storm, tossed but detached.
Meet me at Leonardo da Vinci Airport, Kohler's words echoed.
The uncertain shadows that had fogged Langdon's mind all morning, in a single instant solidified into a vivid image. As he stood there in the swirl of confusion, he felt a door inside him open, as if some mystic threshold had just been breached. The ambigram, the murdered priest-slash-scientist, the antimatter, and now the target. Leonardo da Vinci Airport could only mean one thing. In a moment of stark realization, Langdon knew he had just crossed over. He had become a believer. 5 kilotons. Let there be light. 2 paramedics materialized, racing across the atrium in white smocks. They knelt by Kohler, putting an oxygen mask on his face. Scientists in the hall stopped and stood back. Kohler took 2 long pulls, pushed the mask aside, and still gasping for air, looked up at Vittoria and Langdon.
Rome!
Rome!
Vittoria demanded.
The antimatter is in Rome? Who called?
Kohler's face was twisted, his gray eyes watering.
The Swiss.
He choked on the words, and the paramedics put the mask back over his face.
As they prepared to take him away, Kohler reached up and grabbed Langdon's arm. Langdon nodded. He knew.
Go! Kohler wheezed beneath his mask. Go! Call me!
Then the paramedics were rolling him away. Vittoria stood riveted to the floor, watching him go. Then she turned to Langdon.
Rome! But what was that about the Swiss?
Langdon put a hand on her shoulder, barely whispering the words.
The Swiss Guard, he said.
The sworn sentinels of Vatican City. Chapter 31. The X-33 spaceplane roared into the sky and arced south toward Rome. On board, Langdon sat in silence. The last 15 minutes had been a blur. Now that he had finished briefing Vittoria on the Illuminati and their covenant against the Vatican, the scope of the situation was starting to sink in.
What the hell am I doing? Langdon wondered. I should have gone home when I had the chance.
Deep down, though, he knew he'd never had the chance.
Langdon's better judgment had screamed at him to return to Boston. Nonetheless, academic astonishment had somehow vetoed prudence. Everything he had ever believed about the demise of the Illuminati was suddenly looking like a brilliant sham. Part of him craved proof, confirmation. There was also a question of conscience. With Kohler ailing and Vittoria on her own, Langdon knew that if his knowledge of the Illuminati could assist in any way, he had a moral obligation to be here. There was more, though. Although Langdon was ashamed to admit it, his initial horror on hearing about the antimatter's location was not only the danger to human life in Vatican City, but for something else as well. Art. The world's largest art collection was now sitting on a time bomb. The Vatican Museum housed over 60,000 priceless pieces in 1,407 rooms. Michelangelo, Da Vinci, Bernini, Botticelli. Langdon wondered if all of the art could possibly be evacuated if necessary. He knew it was impossible. Many of the pieces were sculptures weighing tons. Not to mention, the greatest treasures were architectural. The Sistine Chapel, St. Peter's Basilica, Michelangelo's famed spiral staircase leading to the Museo Vaticano. Priceless testaments to man's creative genius. Langdon wondered how much time was left on the canister.
Thanks for coming, Vittoria said, her voice quiet. Langdon emerged from his daydream and looked up. Vittoria was sitting across the aisle. Even in the stark, fluorescent light of the cabin, there was an aura of composure about her, an almost magnetic radiance of wholeness. Her breathing seemed deeper now, as if a spark of self-preservation had ignited within her, a craving for justice and retribution fueled by a daughter's love. Vittoria hadn't had time to change from her shorts and sleeveless top, and her tawny legs were now goosebumped in the cold of the plane. Instinctively, Langdon removed his jacket and offered it to her.
American chivalry?
She accepted, her eyes thanking him silently. The plane jostled across some turbulence, and Langdon felt a surge of danger. The windowless cabin felt cramped again, and he tried to imagine himself in an open field. The notion, he realized, was ironic. He had been in an open field when it had happened. Crushing darkness. He pushed the memory from his mind.
Ancient history.
Vittoria was watching him.
Do you believe in God, Mr. Langdon?
The question startled him. The earnestness in Vittoria's voice was even more disarming than the inquiry.
Do I believe in God?
He had hoped for a lighter topic of conversation to pass the trip. A spiritual conundrum, Langdon thought. That's what my friends call me. Although he studied religion for years, Langdon was not a religious man. He respected the power of faith, the benevolence of churches, the strength religion gave so many people. And yet for him, the intellectual suspension of disbelief that was imperative if one were truly going to believe had always proved too big an obstacle for his academic mind.
I want to believe, he heard himself say.
Vittoria's reply carried no judgment or challenge.
So why don't you?
He chuckled. Well, it's not that easy. Having faith requires leaps of faith, cerebral acceptance of miracles, immaculate conceptions, and divine interventions. And then there are the codes of conduct, the Bible, the Quran, Buddhist scripture. They all carry similar requirements and similar penalties. They claim that if I don't live by a specific code, I will go to hell. I can't imagine a god who would rule that way. I hope you don't let your students dodge questions that shamelessly. The comment caught him off guard.
What?
Mr. Langdon, I did not ask if you believe what man says about God. I asked if you believed in God. There is a difference. Holy Scripture is stories, legends, and history of man's quest to understand his own need for meaning. I'm not asking you to pass judgment on literature. I'm asking if you believe in God. When you lie out under the stars, do you sense the divine? Do you feel in your gut that you're staring up at the work of God's hand? Langdon took a long moment to consider it.
I'm prying,
Vittoria apologized. No, I just... Certainly you must debate issues of faith with your classes.
Endlessly.
And you play devil's advocate, I imagine, always fueling the debate. Langdon smiled. You must be a teacher, too.
No,
but I learned from a master. My father could argue two sides of a Möbius strip. Langdon laughed, picturing the artful crafting of a Möbius strip, a twisted ring of paper which technically possessed only one side. Langdon had first seen the single-sided shape in the artwork of M.C. Escher.
May I ask you a question, Miss Vetra?
Call me Vittoria. Miss Vetra makes me feel old. He sighed inwardly, suddenly sensing his own age.
Vittoria, I'm Robert.
You had a question?
Yes. As a scientist and the daughter of a Catholic priest, what do you think of religion?
Vittoria paused, brushing a lock of hair from her eyes.
Religion is like language or dress. We gravitate toward the practices with which we were raised. In the end, though, we are all proclaiming the same thing, that life has meaning, that we're grateful for the power that created us.
Langdon was intrigued.
So you're saying that whether you're a Christian or a Muslim simply depends on where you were born?
Isn't it obvious?
Look at the diffusion of religion around the world.
So faith is random?
Hardly. Faith is universal.
Our specific methods for understanding it are arbitrary.
Some of us pray to Jesus, some of us go to Mecca, some of us study subatomic particles. In the end, we are all just searching for truth, that which is greater than ourselves.
Langdon wished his students could express themselves so clearly.
Hell, he wished he could express himself so clearly.
And God, he asked, do you believe in God? Vittoria was silent for a long time.
Science tells me God must exist. My mind tells me I will never understand God. And my heart tells me I am not meant to.
How's that for concise, he thought.
So you believe God is fact, but we will never understand him.
Her, she said with a smile. Your Native Americans had it right.
Langdon chuckled. Mother Earth?
Gia.
The planet is an organism. All of us are cells with different purposes, and yet we are intertwined, serving each other, serving the whole.
Looking at her, Langdon felt something stir within him that he had not felt in a long time. There was a bewitching clarity in her eyes, a purity in her voice. He felt drawn.
Mr. Langdon, let me ask you another question.
Robert, he said, Mr. Langdon makes me feel old. I am old.
If you don't mind my asking, Robert, how did you get involved with the Illuminati?
Langdon thought back. Actually, it was money.
Vittoria looked disappointed.
Money?
Consulting, you mean?
Langdon laughed, realizing how it must have sounded.
No, no, money as in currency. He reached in his pants pocket and pulled out some money. He found a $1 bill. I became fascinated with the cult when I first learned that U.S. currency is covered with Illuminati symbology. Vittoria's eyes narrowed, apparently not knowing whether or not to take him seriously. Langdon handed her the bill. Look at the back. See the great seal on the left? Vittoria turned the $1 bill over.
You mean the pyramid?
The pyramid. Do you know what pyramids have to do with U.S. history? Vittoria shrugged. Exactly, Langdon said. Absolutely nothing. Vittoria frowned. So why is it the central symbol of your great seal? An eerie bit of history, Langdon said. The pyramid is an occult symbol representing a convergence upward toward the ultimate source of illumination. See what's above it? Vittoria studied the bill. An eye inside a triangle. It's called the trinacria. Have you ever seen that eye in a triangle anywhere else? Vittoria was silent a moment.
Actually, yes, but I'm not sure.
It's emblazoned on Masonic lodges around the world.
The symbol is Masonic?
Actually, no, it's Illuminati. They called it their Shining Delta, a call for enlightened change. The eye signifies the Illuminati's ability to infiltrate and watch all things. The shining triangle represents enlightenment, and the triangle is also the Greek letter Delta, which is the mathematical symbol for
change, transition.
Langdon smiled. I forgot I was talking to a scientist.
So you're saying the U.S. Great Seal is a call for enlightenment, all-seeing change?
Some would call it a new world order. Vittoria seemed startled. She glanced down at the bill again.
The writing under the pyramid says, Novus Ordo.
Novus Ordo Seclorum, Langdon said. It means new secular order.
Secular as in non-religious?
Non-religious. The phrase not only clearly states the Illuminati objective, but it also blatantly contradicts the phrase beside it, In God we trust. Vittoria seemed troubled. But how could all this symbology end up on the most powerful currency in the world? Most academics believe it was through Vice President Henry Wallace. He was an upper echelon Mason, and certainly had ties to the Illuminati. Whether it was as a member or innocently under their influence, nobody knows. But it was Wallace who sold the design of the Great Seal to the president.
How? Why would the president have agreed to...
The president was Franklin D. Roosevelt. Wallace simply told him Novus Ordo Seclorum meant New Deal. Vittoria seemed skeptical.
And Roosevelt didn't have anyone else look at the symbol before telling the Treasury to print it?
No need. He and Wallace were like brothers.
Brothers?
Check your history books, Langdon said with a smile. Franklin D. Roosevelt was a well-known Mason. Chapter 32. Langdon held his breath as the X-33 spiraled into Rome's Leonardo da Vinci International Airport. Vittoria sat across from him, eyes closed, as if trying to will the situation into control. The craft touched down and taxied to a private hangar.
Sorry for the slow flight.
The pilot apologized, emerging from the cockpit. Had to trim her back. Noise regulations over populated areas. Langdon checked his watch. They had been airborne 37 minutes. The pilot popped the outer door.
Anybody want to tell me what's going on?
Neither Vittoria nor Langdon responded.
Fine, he said, stretching. I'll be in the cockpit with the air conditioning and my music. Just me and Garth.
The late afternoon sun blazed outside the hangar. Langdon carried his tweed jacket over his shoulder. Vittoria turned her face skyward and inhaled deeply, as if the sun's rays somehow transferred to her some mystical replenishing energy. Mediterraneans, Langdon mused, already sweating.
Little old for cartoons, aren't you?
Vittoria asked, without opening her eyes. I'm sorry?
Your wristwatch. I saw it on the plane.
Langdon flushed slightly. He was accustomed to having to defend his timepiece. The collector's edition Mickey Mouse watch had been a childhood gift from his parents. Despite the contorted foolishness of Mickey's outstretched arms designating the hour, it was the only watch Langdon had ever worn. Waterproof and glow-in-the-dark, it was perfect for swimming laps or walking unlit college paths at night. When Langdon's students questioned his fashion sense, he told them he wore Mickey as a daily reminder to stay young at heart.
"It's 6 o'clock," he said.
Victoria nodded, eyes still closed. "I think our ride's here."
Langdon heard the distant whine, looked up, and felt a sinking feeling. Approaching from the north was a helicopter, slicing low across the runway. Langdon had been on a helicopter once in the Andean Palpa Valley, looking at the Nazca sand drawings, and had not enjoyed it one bit. A flying shoebox. After a morning of space plane rides, Langdon had hoped the Vatican would send a car. Apparently not. The chopper slowed overhead, hovered a moment, and dropped toward the runway in front of them. The craft was white and carried a coat of arms emblazoned on the side, two skeleton keys crossing a shield and papal crown. He knew the symbol well. It was the traditional seal of the Vatican, the sacred symbol of the Holy See, or Holy Seat of government, the seat being literally the ancient throne of St. Peter. "The Holy Chopper," Langdon groaned, watching the craft land. He'd forgotten the Vatican owned one of these things, used for transporting the Pope to the airport, to meetings, or to his summer palace in Gandolfo. Langdon definitely would have preferred a car. The pilot jumped from the cockpit and strode toward them across the tarmac. Now it was Victoria who looked uneasy.
"That's our pilot?"
Langdon shared her concern. "To fly or not to fly, that is the question." The pilot looked like he was festooned for a Shakespearean melodrama. His puffy tunic was vertically striped in brilliant blue and gold. He wore matching pantaloons and spats. On his feet were black flats that looked like slippers. On top of it all, he wore a black felt beret. "Traditional Swiss Guard uniforms," Langdon explained, "designed by Michelangelo himself." As the man drew closer, Langdon winced. "I admit, not one of Michelangelo's better efforts." Despite the man's garish attire, Langdon could tell the pilot meant business. He moved toward them with all the rigidity and dignity of a U.S. Marine. Langdon had read many times about the rigorous requirements for becoming one of the elite Swiss Guard. Recruited from one of Switzerland's 4 Catholic cantons, applicants had to be Swiss males between 19 and 30 years old, at least 5 feet 6 inches, trained by the Swiss Army, and unmarried. This Imperial Corps was envied by world governments as the most allegiant and deadly security force in the world. "Are you from CERN?" the guard asked, arriving before them. His voice was steely.
"Yes, sir," Langdon replied.
"You made remarkable time," he said, giving the X-33 a mystified stare. He turned to Victoria. "Ma'am, do you have any other clothing?"
"I beg your pardon?"
He motioned to her legs.
"Short pants are not permitted inside Vatican City."
Langdon glanced down at Victoria's legs and frowned. He had forgotten. Vatican City had a strict ban on visible legs above the knee, both male and female. The regulation was a way of showing respect for the sanctity of God's city.
"This is all I have," she said. "We came in a hurry."
The guard nodded, clearly displeased. He turned next to Langdon. "Are you carrying any weapons?"
"Weapons?" Langdon thought.
"I'm not even carrying a change of underwear." He shook his head. The officer crouched at Langdon's feet and began patting him down, starting at his socks. "Trusting guy," Langdon thought. The guard's strong hands moved up Langdon's legs, coming uncomfortably close to his groin. Finally, they moved up to his chest and shoulders. Apparently content Langdon was clean, the guard turned to Victoria. He ran his eyes up her legs and torso.
Vittoria glared.
Don't even think about it.
The guard fixed Vittoria with a gaze clearly intended to intimidate. Vittoria didn't flinch.
What's that?
The guard said, pointing to a faint square bulge in the front pocket of her shorts. Vittoria removed an ultra-thin cell phone. The guard took it, clicked it on, waited for a dial tone, and then, apparently satisfied that it was indeed nothing more than a phone, returned it to her. Vittoria slid it back into her pocket.
Turn around, please,
the guard said. Vittoria obliged, holding her arms out and rotating a full 360 degrees. The guard carefully studied her. Langdon had already decided that Vittoria's form-fitting shorts and blouse were not bulging anywhere they shouldn't have been. Apparently the guard came to the same conclusion.
Thank you. This way, please.
The Swiss Guard chopper churned in neutral as Langdon and Vittoria approached. Vittoria boarded first, like a seasoned pro, barely even stopping as she passed beneath the whirling rotors. Langdon held back a moment.
No chance of a car,
he yelled, half-joking to the Swiss guard, who was climbing in the pilot's seat. The man didn't answer. Langdon knew that with Rome's maniacal drivers, flying was probably safer anyway. He took a deep breath and boarded, stooping cautiously as he passed beneath the spinning rotors. As the guard fired up the engines, Vittoria called out,
"Have you located the canister?"
The guard glanced over his shoulder, looking confused.
"The what?"
"The canister. You called CERN about a canister." The man shrugged.
"No idea what you're talking about. We've been very busy today. My commander told me to pick you up. That's all I know."
Vittoria gave Langdon an unsettled look.
"Buckle up, please,"
the pilot said as the engine revved. Langdon reached for his seatbelt and strapped himself in. The tiny fuselage seemed to shrink around him. Then, with a roar, the craft shot up and banked sharply north toward Rome.
Rome, the Caput Mundi,
where Caesar once ruled, where St. Peter was crucified, the cradle of modern civilization, and at its core, a ticking bomb. Chapter 33. Rome from the air is a labyrinth, an indecipherable maze of ancient roadways winding around buildings, fountains, and crumbling ruins. The Vatican chopper stayed low in the sky as it sliced northwest through the permanent smog layer coughed up by the congestion below. Langdon gazed down at the mopeds, sightseeing buses, and armies of miniature Fiat sedans buzzing around rotaries in all directions. Koyana squatsi, he thought, recalling the Hopi term for life out of balance. Vittoria sat in silent determination in the seat beside him. The chopper banked hard. His stomach dropping, Langdon gazed farther into the distance. His eyes found the crumbling ruins of the Roman Colosseum. The Colosseum, Langdon had always thought, was one of history's greatest ironies. Now a dignified symbol for the rise of human culture and civilization, the stadium had been built to host centuries of barbaric events. Hungry lions shredding prisoners. Armies of slaves battling to the death. Gang rapes of exotic women captured from far-off lands, as well as public beheadings and castrations. It was ironic, Langdon thought, or perhaps fitting, that the Colosseum had served as the architectural blueprint for Harvard's Soldier Field, the football stadium where the ancient traditions of savagery were reenacted every fall, crazed fans screaming for bloodshed as Harvard battled Yale. As the chopper headed north, Langdon spied the Roman Forum, the heart of pre-Christian Rome. The decaying columns looked like toppled gravestones in a cemetery that had somehow avoided being swallowed by the metropolis surrounding it. To the west, the wide basin of the Tiber River wound enormous arcs across the city. Even from the air, Langdon could tell the water was deep. The churning currents were brown, filled with silt and foam from heavy rains.
"Straight ahead," the pilot said, climbing higher.
Langdon and Vittoria looked out and saw it. Like a mountain parting the morning fog, the colossal dome rose out of the haze before them. St. Peter's Basilica.
"Now that," Langdon said to Vittoria, "is something Michelangelo got right."
Langdon had never seen St. Peter's from the air. The marble facade blazed like fire in the afternoon sun. Adorned with 140 statues of saints, martyrs, and angels, the Herculean edifice stretched 2 football fields wide and a staggering 6 long. The cavernous interior of the basilica had room for over 60,000 worshippers, over 100 times the population of Vatican City, the smallest country in the world. Incredibly, though, not even a citadel of this magnitude could dwarf the piazza before it. A sprawling expanse of granite, St. Peter's Square was a staggering open space in the congestion of Rome, like a classical central park. In front of the basilica, bordering the vast oval common, 284 columns swept outward in 4 concentric arcs of diminishing size. An architectural trompe-l'oeil used to heighten the piazza's sense of grandeur. As he stared at the magnificent shrine before him, Langdon wondered what St. Peter would think if he were here now. The saint had died a gruesome death, crucified upside down on this very spot. Now he rested in the most sacred of tombs, buried 5 stories down, directly beneath the central cupola of the basilica.
"Vatican City," the pilot said, sounding anything but welcoming.
Langdon looked out at the towering stone bastions that loomed ahead, impenetrable fortifications surrounding the complex, a strangely earthly defense for a spiritual world of secrets, power, and mystery.
"Look," Vittoria said suddenly, grabbing Langdon's arm. She motioned frantically downward toward St. Peter's Square directly beneath them. Langdon put his face to the window and looked.
"Over there," she said, pointing. Langdon looked. The rear of the piazza looked like a parking lot crowded with a dozen or so trailer trucks. Huge satellite dishes pointed skyward from the roof of every truck. The dishes were emblazoned with familiar names.
Televisor Europeo, Video Italia, BBC, United Press International.
Langdon felt suddenly confused, wondering if the news of the antimatter had already leaked out. Vittoria seemed suddenly tense. "Why is the press here? What's going on?" The pilot turned and gave her an odd look over his shoulder.
"What's going on? You don't know?"
"No," she fired back.
"Il conclavo," he said. "It is to be sealed in about an hour. The whole world is watching."
Il conclavo. The word rang a long moment in Langdon's ears before dropping like a brick to the pit of his stomach. Il conclavo. The Vatican conclave. How could he have forgotten? It had been in the news recently. 15 days ago, the Pope, after a tremendously popular 12-year reign, had passed away. Every paper in the world had carried the story about the Pope's fatal stroke while sleeping. A sudden and unexpected death, many whispered, was suspicious. But now, in keeping with the sacred tradition, 15 days after the death of a pope, the Vatican was holding Il Conclavo, the sacred ceremony in which the 165 cardinals of the world, the most powerful men in Christendom, gathered in Vatican City to elect the new pope. "Every cardinal on the planet is here today," Langdon thought, as the chopper passed over St. Peter's Basilica. The expansive inner world of Vatican City spread out beneath him. The entire power structure of the Roman Catholic Church is sitting on a time bomb. Chapter 34. Cardinal Mortati gazed up at the lavish ceiling of the Sistine Chapel and tried to find a moment of quiet reflection. The frescoed walls echoed with the voices of cardinals from nations around the globe. The men jostled in the candlelit tabernacle, whispering excitedly and consulting with one another in numerous languages, the universal tongues being English, Italian, and Spanish. The light in the chapel was usually sublime, long rays of tinted sun slicing through the darkness like rays from heaven. but not today. As was the custom, all of the chapel's windows had been covered in black velvet in the name of secrecy. This ensured that no one on the inside